Well, perhaps we have overstayed our welcome, Tom said, and beamed round the room. The family was seated in the counting-house of the high-wheeled go-down. Sarah Courtney tried to show her disapproval in sternness, but an expression of resignation was not entirely hidden by her lowered lids. "He will never cease to amaze me, this husband of mine," she thought. "He revels in circumstances that would devastate other men." "I think Tom is right," Dorian joined in between puffs on his hookah. "We Courtneys have always been voyagers on the oceans and wanderers on the continents. 20 years in one spot on this earth is too long." "You're talking about my home," Yasmini protested, "the place where I've spent half my life and where my only son was born." "We will find both you and Sarah another home and give you both more sons, if that is what it will make you happy," Dorian promised. "You're as bad as your brother," Sarah rounded on him. "You don't understand a woman's heart." "Or her mind," Tom chuckled. "Come now, my sweeting, we cannot stay here to be beggared by Vandenwitten. You've been forced to up sticks and run before. Don't you remember how we had to clear out of Fort Providence at 5 minutes' notice, when Zayn al-Din's men came calling? I shall never forget it. You threw my harpsichord overboard to lighten the ship so we could clear the sandbars at the mouth of the river." "Ah, but I bought you another," Tom said, and they all glanced across the room to the triangular instrument standing against the inner wall. Sarah stood up and crossed to it. She opened the lid of the keyboard, took her seat on the stool, and played the opening bars of Spanish Ladies. Tom hummed the chorus. Abruptly, Sarah closed the lid and stood up. There were tears in her eyes. "That was a long time ago, Tom Courtney, when I was a silly young girl." "Young? Yes. Silly? Never!" Tom went to her quickly and placed an arm around her shoulders. "Tom, I'm too old to start all over again," she whispered. "Nonsense! You're as young and strong as you ever were." "We will be destitute," Sarah mourned. "Beggars and homeless wanderers." "If you think that, you do not know me as well as you think you do." Still holding her fondly, he looked at his brother. "Shall we show them, Dorry?" "There'll be no peace for us if we don't," Dorian shrugged. "They are scolds and martinets, these women of ours." Yasmini leaned over and tugged his curling red beard. "I have always been a dutiful Muslim wife to you, Al-Salil." She used his Arabic name, the Drawn Sword. "How dare you accuse me of disrespect? Recant at once, or you shall be deprived of all favours and privileges until next Ramadan comes round." "You are so lovely, full moon on my life. You grow sweeter and more docile with each day that passes." "I shall take that as a recantation." She smiled, and her great dark eyes glowed at him. "Enough," cried Tom. "This dispute tears apart our family and our hearts." They all laughed, even the women, and Tom seized the advantage. "You know that Dorian and I were never such fools as to trust that gang of footpads and cutpurses who make up the board of governors of the VOC," he said. "We always knew that we were in this colony under sufferance," Dorian went on. "The Dutch looked upon us as milch cows. For the last 20 years they had been sucking our udders dry." "Well, not entirely dry," Tom demurred, and went to the bookcase at the far end of the room, which reached from floor to ceiling. "Lend a hand here, brother," he said, and Dorian went to help him. The bookcase, filled with heavy leather-bound tomes, was set on steel rollers, cunningly concealed beneath the dark wooden skirting board. With both of them shoving at one end, it slid aside, with squealing protest from the rollers, to reveal a small door in the back wall, barred with iron cross-bolts and locked with an enormous bronze padlock. Tom lifted down a book, whose spine was embossed in gold leaf, Monsters of the Southern Oceans. He opened the covers. In the hollowed-out interior lay a key. "Bring the lantern," he told Sarah, as he turned the key in the padlock, shot back the bolts, and opened the door. "How did you keep this from us over all these years?" Sarah demanded. "With the greatest difficulty," Tom took her hand and led her into a tiny room, not much bigger than a cupboard. Dorian and Yasmini followed. There was barely enough space for them all, and the stack of small wooden chests piled neatly against the far wall. "The family fortune," Tom explained. "The profits of 20 years. We did not have the reckless courage or the lack of good sense to entrust it to the Bank of Batavia, which is owned by all our old friends in Amsterdam, the VOC. He opened the top chest, which was packed to the brim with small canvas bags. Tom handed one of the bags to each of the women. "So heavy," Yasmini exclaimed, and nearly dropped hers. "Ain't nothing heavier," Tom agreed. When Sarah opened the mouth of the bag she held, she gasped. "Gold coins? All three chests filled with gold?" "Naturally, my sweeting. We pay our expenses in silver and keep the profits in gold."
"Tom Courtenay, you are a dark horse. Why did you never tell us of this hoard?"
"There was never a reason until now," he laughed. "The knowledge would have made you discontent, but now it has taken a weight off your heart."
"How much have you and Dorry squirreled away in here?" Yasmini asked in wonder.
Tom knocked with his knuckles on each of the three chests in turn. "Seems all three are still full. This is the most part of our savings. In addition, we have an ample collection of sapphires from Ceylon and diamonds from the fabulous Kollur mine on the Krishna River in India. They are all large stones of the first water. If not quite a king's ransom, then at least a Raja's," he chuckled richly. "In truth, that's not quite all. Both our ships lying in the bay have their weighty cargoes still intact. To say nothing of two platoons of VOC soldiers on board as well," Sarah pointed out spicily as she backed out of the concealed strongroom.
"That presents an interesting problem," Tom admitted, as he locked the door, and Dorian helped him push the bookcase back into position to cover it.
"But one that's not insoluble." He went to take his seat again and patted the chair next to him.
"Come, sit beside me, Sarah Courtenay. I'm going to need the benefit of your sharp wit and famous erudition now."
"I think it's time that we invited Mansur to join the family deliberations," Dorian suggested. "He's old enough at last, and what's more, his life will be changed as profoundly as ours when we sail out of Table Bay. He'll probably be distraught to be taken from his childhood home."
"Quite right," Tom agreed. "But now speed is everything. Our exodus must take Van der Witten and Kayser by surprise. They cannot be expecting us to abandon High Weald and all its contents. There's a great deal to be seen to, but we must set ourselves a limit." He looked up at Dorian.
3 days?
"It will be a close-run thing," Dorian frowned as he considered it. "But yes, we can be ready to sail in 3 days."
Those 3 days were filled with frenzied activity carefully concealed from the rest of the world. It was essential that even the most trusted of their servants had no inkling of their true intentions. Loyalty did not presuppose discretion. The serving girls were notorious chatterboxes, and the chambermaids even worse. Many had romantic attachments to men in the town, and a few consorted with the soldiers and petty officers in the castle. To allay any suspicions, Sarah and Yasmini put it about that the sorting and packing of clothes and furniture was merely a seasonal reordering and cleaning of the rambling homestead. In the godown, Tom and Dorian conducted their annual stock-taking 3 months earlier than their usual custom. An English East Indiaman was lying at anchor in the bay, and the captain was an old and trusted friend of Tom. They had dealt with each other over the last 20 years. Tom sent him an invitation to dinner, and during the meal swore him to secrecy and informed him of their plans to leave Good Hope. Then he sold him the entire contents of the godown at High Weald for a fraction of its real value. In return, Captain Wells promised not to take possession until after the two Courtenay ships had sailed from the bay. He undertook to make payment for the goods directly into the CBTC account at Mr. Coote's bank in Piccadilly immediately on his return to London. The land and buildings of High Weald were held under perpetual quit-rent to the VOC. Mynheer van der Velde, another prosperous burgher of the colony, had been importuning Tom and Dorian for years to sell the estate to him. After midnight, the brothers, dressed in black, their faces covered by the brims of their hats and the collars of their greatcoats, rode across to his homestead on the banks of the Black River and knocked on the shutters of van der Velde's bedroom. After his initial alarm, angry shouts and threats, he came out in his nightshirt brandishing a bell-mouthed blunderbuss.
He shone his lantern into their faces. "Name of a dog! Is it you?" he exclaimed, and led them into his counting-house.
As the first light of dawn paled the sky, and the doves cooed in the oaks outside the windows, they shook hands on the bargain. Tom and Dorian signed the deed of transfer of High-Weald, and grinning triumphantly, Funderfelder handed over an irrevocable letter of credit drawn on the Bank of Batavia for an amount less than half of what he had been prepared to pay for it only a few months before. On the planned evening of departure, as the sun set and the light faded, when they could not be observed from the beach or the castle walls, Mansur and a small crew rowed out to the anchored ships. Kayser had placed 6 Hottentot troopers under a corporal on board each. After 5 days at anchor, with the vessels pitching and rolling in the steep swells kicked up by the southeaster, those soldiers who were not prostrated with seasickness were bored and disenchanted with this duty. To add to their misery, they could see the lights of the taverns along the beachfront and hear snatches of song and revelry drifting across the dark, wind-churned surface from the shore. Mansur's arrival alongside was a pleasant distraction, and they crowded the rail to exchange jests and friendly insults with him and his rowers. Mansur was a favourite of the Hottentot community in the colony. The nickname they had bestowed upon him was Specht, woodpecker, for his fiery topknot.
"You're not allowed on board, Specht," the corporal told him sternly. "Colonel Kayser's orders, no visitors allowed."
"Do not fuss yourself, I'm not coming on board. I would not want to be seen in the company of such rogues and ruffians," Mansur shouted back.
"So you say, old Specht, but then what are you doing here? You should be giving the girls in the village sewing lessons."
The corporal shouted with laughter at his own wit. The word nigh had a double meaning, not only to sew, but also to fornicate. Mansur's red hair and startling good looks rendered him almost irresistible to the members of the fair sex.
"It's my birthday," Mansur told them, "and I brought a present for you."
He kicked the keg of Cape Bronnevane that lay in the bottom of the boat.
"Send down a cargo net."
They jumped to obey, and the keg swayed up onto the deck. The muslin captain of the Gift of Allah came up from his cabin to protest at this devil's brew, forbidden by the Prophet, coming on board.
"Peace be upon you, Batula," Mansur called to him in Arabic. "These men are my friends."
Batula had been Dorian's lance-bearer in the early days in the deserts. They had spent most of their lives together, and the links between them were of iron. Batula had known Mansur from the day of his birth. He recognized Mansur's voice, and his anger abated a little. He consoled himself that all his men were believers, and they would not be tempted by Satan's liquor, unlike the Kaffir soldiers. The Hottentot corporal knocked the bung out of the brandy keg and filled a pewter mug. He took a mouthful of the neat spirits, gasped, and exhaled the fumes noisily.
"Ismar," he exclaimed, "this lecker! It's so good!"
Mugs in hand, his men crowded round him for their turn at the keg. But the corporal relented his former strictures and called down to Mansur,
"Hey, Specht, come on board and share a cup!"
Mansur waved an apology as they pulled away and headed for the other ship.
"Not now. Perhaps later. I have another present for your men on the Maid of York."